study and prepare, but
I'll just be honest with you. This house thing has just keeps me so occupied during the week that I'm ashamed to admit that I have little time to even think about the services until I know that the time is coming up and I try to prepare for it. It's not anything that I'm proud of. I'm just thankful that it's about over with. Lord willing, we'll get into the house this week. If the certificate of occupancy is, they give it to us, I'm willing to live there with my wife and the dogs and sleep on the floor if necessary. But this too shall pass. We've been down these roads before, but you know we get our minds on the earthly things so often that it just pulls us away from where we ought to be. And that's a little bit about what my thoughts are this morning. I have tried to prepare and study, and I try never to come unprepared, but I try to come prepared to let the Lord have His way. And if He changes my mind and takes me in another direction, I pray that He'll give me the grace to follow Him rather than to go a direction that I may have prepared to go. But we'll do our best this morning to try to follow the Lord. I'd like to take a reading this morning from the book of Judges in the second chapter. This thought's been on my mind for a while, and I still don't know exactly how to develop it. I trust the Lord will help us do that this morning. But nothing that we do amounts to anything unless God is in it. As we discussed in our Sunday school this morning, we need to put forth our best effort to do all that we can, but we're not the one who really makes the difference. God is the one who makes the difference, and unless the Holy Spirit put an unction upon the things that we say and put power, His power, in those words and in those thoughts, they really don't just amount to much. So we trust that the Lord will help us this morning, open our thoughts and understanding and yours as well. In the book of Judges, in the second chapter, I'd like to read about the first 10 verses. It says, "And an angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I made you go up out of Egypt and have brought you unto the land which I swear unto your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you. And you shall make no league with the inhabitants of this land. You shall throw down their altars. But you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this? Wherefore I also said, I will not drive them out from before you, but they shall be as thorns in your sides, and their God shall be a snare unto you. And it came to pass, when the angel of the Lord spake these words unto all the children of Israel, that the people lifted up their voice and wept. And they called the name of that place Bochim, and they sacrificed there unto the Lord. And when Joshua had let the people go, the children of Israel went every man into his inheritance to possess the land. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord that he did for Israel. And Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died, being 110 years old. And they buried him at the border of his inheritance in Timnathras, in the Mount of Ephraim, on the north side of the hill Gaash. And also all that generation was gathered unto their fathers, and there arose another generation after them, which knew not the Lord, nor yet the works which he had done for Israel. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and served Balaam." I'm going to stop there. That's enough for a background reading. My thought would come from that second verse where it says, "And he shall make no league with the inhabitants of this land. You shall throw down their altars, but you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this?" Now, I think that's a question that the Lord is continuing to ask all of his people when that we fall into sin and disobey Him. That's basically what He was saying to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden after He had given them some clear direction, and yet they went the other way. And His question was, why have you done this? Who told you that you were naked? And so we find that it's a pertinent question even to us today. And I believe that this is recorded for us in the book of Judges so that we might learn some of the lessons from history. But whether or not that we will certainly remains to be seen. It's not just a history lesson, but there are principles that are involved and are at stake here that the Lord wants us to grasp onto and to follow those same principles, even though we be many years removed from the actual events that took place here. Now, I would point out that in this first verse that we read, it says, "And an angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim." Now, if this is not a prophet, I don't believe that it's speaking. I don't believe that it's one of the leaders of the nation, because generally you'll find in the scriptures, whether it's a prophet or whether it's Moses or someone else, that will begin by saying that the Lord has said. But that's not the case here. The angel said, I have made you go up out of Egypt. And so this appears to be an appearance of the Lord before them, giving them direct information. Now, this angel had appeared unto Joshua at Gilgal. You see, Gilgal was where that they first camped when they came across into the Promised Land. It was there at Gilgal that they no longer received manna from heaven. It was there at Gilgal that they renewed the observance of the Passover. Remember, they'd been 40 years in the wilderness. That whole generation had passed away that had come out of Egypt. Only just a very few remained. Joshua was one of them, and Caleb being the two spies out of the 12 that had gone into the Promised Land and come back and gave a good report. The others gave a negative report. Well, they gave a good report of the land, but they gave a negative report of their ability to take the land because that they had no faith in God. And therefore, God turned that whole generation around and said, "You'll die in the wilderness. You shall not see the land, but your children, who were not of fighting age at that time, who were up to the age of 20, that your children shall see it, inherit the land." And so 40 years later, after they had all died off, and Joshua and Caleb took that group of people and crossed over the Jordan River. And as they entered into the Promised Land, they went first to Gilgal. And there, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joshua. And what he promised Joshua was that, "Just as I was with Moses, I will be with you. I will cast out the inhabitants of the land before you, and I will give this land to you just as I have promised." And so that same angel has now followed them several years later and now appears to them up at Bochim. Now Gilgal, these places were named for events that took place there. They called it Gilgal because the word Gilgal means rolling. And it was there that the Lord rolled away the filth of Egypt, if you will. Because something had happened. What had happened was that, if you remember, before they came up out of Egypt, that they were all, that they had failed for many, many years to fulfill their part of the covenant with God, and that they had lapsed in the circumcision which bound them and showed their allegiance to the covenant that God had made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and all of their forefathers. They had lapsed, and so God required that they reintroduce that, which Moses did. And so that generation came out, but the 40 years that they were in the wilderness, once again, they had let that lapse. And so it was at Gilgal, before that they even began to take the land, that God renewed that covenant with them. And there he told Joshua to take sharp knives and to circumcise all the males that they might re-enter back into that covenant and bind themselves to God, and God would bind himself to them and cast out the enemies of the land. And so the word Gilgal meant rolling back the filth of Egypt, which was still upon them. And so that's what the word meant. Now, the word Bochim means weeping, because as we read here, that there was great weeping because of the message that the angel brought to them. And the message that the angel brought to them was that they had turned away from God, that they had disobeyed God, and that there was a great punishment that was going to take place, and that they were going to that God was not going to be with them any longer to cast out the enemies before them. Now, I didn't read the first chapter of Judges, but that first chapter of Judges, if you go back and read it, tells us why that the angel appeared. The reason that the angel appeared was that after that Joshua had passed away, you see, the book of Judges picks up after Joshua's death. The second chapter just goes back and picks up a little bit from the last couple of chapters of Joshua. But the first chapter of Judges actually picks up after Joshua's death. And what we find is that after Joshua's death, that they had to continue to inhabit the land. You see, this taking of Canaan was not a one-time affair. It was not something that was done overnight. It was a continuous process. Canaan land, the promised land, did not represent heaven and a perfect rest with God. That is yet to come. Canaan was the promised land, but there was work to be done. There were enemies to be cast out. There was territory to be taken. And Joshua, all the days that he lived, and those that were with him that had seen the great things of God, they did their job, and they proceeded, and they cast out many of the enemies. But it tells us back, I believe it's in the 23rd chapter of Joshua, that Joshua gathered them together, and I'll read that in just a moment. Joshua had gathered them together, and he said that there are still enemies that are remaining in the land. There are still tribes and hostile groups of people that have not yet been cast out. It is your job, as you move forward, to cast those out of the land. And just as God has been with me and us and has helped us to cast those out, as you move forward in order to take your inheritance, he will be with you as well. And so what the first chapter of Judges tells us is that they met resistance. They met resistance along the way after Joshua's death. And rather than cast the enemy out, they made allegiances with him. They made alliances with them. And they just left them alone and began to share the land with them. And God was angry about that because he had given them specific instructions of what to do and what not to do. Now, let's understand, first of all, that God said here in this first verse that I read, that I swear unto your fathers and I said, I will never break my covenant with you. God has never, ever broken a covenant that he's made. He never broke one with Israel. He never broke one with Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob. God is a covenant keeper. It's always the other part of the covenant, those of us who end up breaking that covenant. And God reminds them at the very first outset of his condemnation of them that I promised your fathers I would never break my covenant with you, and I have not. God fulfilled everything that he said that he would do. Back in the book of Joshua, in the 23rd chapter, Joshua calls them all together. And as he has them all together, here's what it says in the 14th verse of the 23rd chapter. And behold, this day, Joshua's talking, this day I am going the way of all the earth. And you know, in all of your hearts and in all your souls, that not one thing hath failed of all the good things which the Lord your God spake concerning you. All are come to pass unto you, and not one thing hath failed thereof. God brought them into the land just as He promised that He would. He cast out the enemies before them just as He said that He would. But we find that all along the way, they disobeyed the voice of God. They did not do what they were instructed to do. Joshua himself made a grave error when he made league with one of the nations in the land. They deceived him because they were afraid, and they came before the army of Israel, and they said, "Oh, we come from a distant land, nowhere close to you, and we've heard of how great that your God is and how powerful that you are, and we're fearful of that, and we would like to just make an alliance with you." Well, Joshua didn't find out who they were. It was these next door neighbors, and so he made an alliance with them. And once he had made that alliance with them, there were thorns in his side and the side of the people of Israel all the days of their life. And so it was that God had told them what to do and what not to do, and that they were to cast out all the enemies. And so God kept His end of the bargain in every way that He promised that He would. Now, there are those today who teach that God still has to keep His promise to Israel and put them back in the land. I'm telling you that God already kept His promise. They're the ones who broke it. God told them at the very time that He brought them into the land that you are to obey My voice, you are to follow after My covenant, and if you don't, then I will cast you out of the land. And so we find that any failure was not on God's part, it was on the people's part. And exactly what God told them came to pass. And I'll get to that in just a moment. But first of all, I want you to mark that down, that God kept His promise in everything that He said that He would do. And Joshua called them to account for that. You know, he said to all the people, to all the elders, to all the people that were gathered there, you know in your heart that God has kept His word. Not one thing is lacking. Everything has come to pass. So any failure is not on God's part. It'll be on your part. And so God clearly kept His promise. But we also need to understand that God's instructions to them were very clear. Very clear. They knew exactly what God expected of them. God has given us clear instructions as Christians. He's given us clear instructions for those who would walk in this life and serve Him of how that we are to behave and the what we are to do and what we're not to do. And we're going to see as this lesson goes along that our problem today as Christians is exactly the same problem that they had, and that is that they made alliances with the people that they were to cast out. And we've made alliances with our sins and continue in them because that we didn't cast them out. But I don't want to get ahead of myself. In the book of Joshua, again in the 23rd chapter, I'd like to pick up and read God's instructions. How clear that they were. He says in the beginning of the second verse, "And Joshua called for all Israel and for their elders and for their heads and for their judges and for their officers and said unto them, I'm old and stricken in age. And you have seen all that the Lord your God hath done unto all these nations because of you. For the Lord your God is He that hath fought for you. Behold, I have divided unto you by lot these nations that remain." Now listen to that. Listen to that. Joshua realizes that the land is not at rest, that there are still enemies to be conquered, that the next generation has work to do, that there are still enemies within the land. And he said, "I divided the land out so that one tribe did get all the enemies, but you have equally been divided out so that you all have work to do. There are enemies that remain in all of your inheritance." And here, so he says, as he divided it out, "Behold, I have divided unto you by lot these nations that remain to be an inheritance for your tribes from Jordan with all the nations that I have cut off, even unto the great sea westward. So see, he had already done his work. Joshua had done all that he could to bring the inheritance to the people. But Joshua was old and about ready to die. And he said, now it's your turn to move forward. And the Lord your God, he shall expel them from before you and drive them from out of your sight. And you shall possess their land, as the Lord your God hath promised unto you. Be ye therefore very courageous to keep and to do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, that you turn not aside therefrom to the right hand nor to the left. And so Joshua tells them clearly, there's still things to be accomplished. There's still enemies to cast out. Clear instructions have been given that you're not to turn to the right hand nor to the left hand, but you're to do all that has been written in the law of the book that God gave to Moses. And you read those first five books that we call the Pentateuch, which are the instructions, the first five books and the instruction of what they were to do, what they were not to do, how that they were to interact with neighbors. All of those things are in there. And Joshua reminds them, you have a clear instruction book. You have a clear way of knowing what God expects of you, what's right and what's wrong. And he says, if you want to conquer this land and you want to get the enemies that out of your inheritance, then you follow God and God will cast them out before you. And so he makes them the same promise that that angel made to him on that day in Gilgal, which is that I will be with you as I was with Moses if you follow the Lord. And so he's making the same promise to them. Be ye therefore very courageous and keep and do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, that you turn not aside therefrom to the right hand or to the left, that you come not among these nations, these that remain among you, neither make mention of the name of their gods, nor cause to swear by them, neither serve them, nor bow yourselves down unto them. But cleave unto the Lord your God, as you have done unto this day. For the Lord hath driven out from before you great nations and strong. But as for you, no man hath been able to stand before you unto this day. One man of you shall chase a thousand, for the Lord your God, he it is that fighteth for you, as he hath promised you. And so God's instructions are very clear to them. This land is yours. Peace awaits you. There's an enemy to be conquered. But if you'll follow my instructions and you'll stay near to me and you'll not get sidetracked and serve other gods and be off among the people of the land, then I will cast out your enemies before you. That's still true today for us folks. We can have peace in a time of trouble. We can have the inheritance of peace in this life if we'll follow the instructions that God has given. He said that he will fulfill his promises to us just as he has our forefathers. I know many of us like to talk about the good old days, the days when that the churches were full, the days when that the people would stand outside and listen to the gospel because the seats were full and the windows were open and sinners would seek the Lord. And what's changed? God has not changed. It's the same God. It's us who has changed. We've become too entangled in the world. We've become too entrenched in the things that should have already been cast out. And so this lesson applies to us, all of us, not just Sulphur Fork, but I'm not here to preach to the rest of them. I'm here to preach to Sulphur Fork and to remind us that we have enemies. Those enemies, many of our children have succumbed to those. Many of them are not here this morning because they've made alliances with the things that they should have left behind when the Lord saved their soul. And the Lord said, come and serve me and leave these things behind. And so the instructions are very clear of how that we can be successful in our walk with God in this life. But we also need to understand that the consequences of disobedience, God made very clear as well. He made them very clear. Now those who stand today and say, well, God still owes the land to Israel, they're ignoring the fact that God told them clearly on every occasion that if you follow me and obey my voice, then you'll stay in the land. But if you fail to do that, I will cast you out of the land and I will take it from you and I will give it to someone else. It was very clear. Let's read that. Let's go on and finish up the rest of that 23rd chapter of Joshua, because Joshua tells them both sides. He gives them the formula for success and also the consequences if they fail to do what God has told them to do. 11th verse. Take heed, therefore, unto yourselves, that you love the Lord your God. Else, if you do in any wise go back and cleave unto the remnant of these nations, even these that remain among you, and shall make marriages with them, and go in unto them, and they to you, know for certainty that the Lord your God will no more drive out any of these nations from before you, but they shall be snares and traps unto you, and scourges in your sides and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from off this good land which the Lord your God hath given you. And so God's instructions for success were clear, and his promise of punishment for disobedience was very clear. And it all rested in whether or not that they went back and went into the things that they were supposed to be separated from. You see, there's one thing that the Bible clearly teaches us from the beginning, and that is that God's people are to be a separate people. We're to be called out of the world, to where we're to be separated from the world. Now, don't say that God was unfair to the Canaanites. Don't say that God was unfair for requiring them to, at the hand of Israel, to be destroyed. God left them in the land and gave them plenty of opportunities. When God told Abraham, took him up on the mountain and showed him the land and said, I'm going to give this land to you, to your posterity, but I can't do it right now because the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. God patiently waited, gave them opportunity to turn away from their false gods, gave them opportunity to turn toward him, gave them opportunity all along the way that they might turn to him and turn away from their filthiness and all that they were involved in, but they did not. They did not do that, and so God was bringing his punishment upon them, and Israel failed God because God was using them as his tool to punish the iniquity of the Amorites and the Canaanites and all those in the land. And so if you have anyone that you want to blame, blame God. Blame God. And yet we see that God gave them opportunity. He gave them opportunity. I believe he gave them opportunity right down to that very last trip that all of the nation made around the walls of Jericho. That right down to the last blowing of that trumpet, when the walls fell down and they began the conquering of the land, they had opportunity right up to that very last minute. And Rahab took advantage of that. Rahab and her family were saved because they believed in God. And so God gave them plenty of opportunity. And he's telling his own people, remain separate from them. They will corrupt you. They will make you like they are rather than you make them like you are. And so he's warning them to make no league with them, not to intermarry with them, and not to bow down to their gods, not to be a part of all of their iniquity, but to remain separate from them. Therefore, it shall come to pass. Well, and behold, this day I'm going the way of all the earth. Yeah, and behold, this day I'm going the way of all the earth, and you know in all your hearts, I read that one earlier, and in all your souls, that not one thing hath failed of all the good thing which the Lord God spake concerning you. All are come to pass unto you, and not one thing hath failed thereof. Therefore, it shall come to pass that as all good things are come upon you, which the Lord your God promised you, so shall the Lord bring upon you all the evil things until he has destroyed you from off this good land, which the Lord your God hath given you. When you have transgressed the covenant of the Lord your God, which He commanded you, and have gone and served other gods and bowed yourselves to them, then shall the anger of the Lord be kindled against you, and you shall perish quickly from off the good land which He has given unto you. And so the warning was very clear. You have this land on lease. And on condition of following my instructions and following my leadership, and failure to do that will have its consequences in your life. Folks, that is true of every one of us. At the moment when God saves us, we cross that Jordan, if you will, and we encamp at Gilgal, when God saves our soul and brings us into that land, and the angel of the Lord appears to us and says that I will cast out all of your enemies before you if you will follow my command and serve me and turn not to the right nor to the left, but don't make alliances, don't make allegiances with those things that you've left in the past. They're still among you. Those things are still there. That drunkenness that you might have had before that you got saved, it's still there. The temptation is still there. All of those things that were supposed to be left behind are still around you, but you can overcome them. You can still defeat them if you will follow my command and follow my leadership. Now, Joshua's generation, they knew the great works of the Lord firsthand. They had seen it. And so therefore they followed the Lord. I've always found this passage to be so condemning to each of us, because that we fail so many times to follow the Lord, and the only thing that's going to help us to do so is to know the Lord firsthand, to see and remember the wonderful things that He has done for us. That generation that saw the power, the hand of God, as the walls of Jericho fell, as the enemy was cast out of the land, all of those things made deep impressions upon them, and they served the Lord all the days of their life. But I tell you what, you cannot be a hand-me-down Christian. You can't be a second-hand Christian. It just doesn't work. You have to serve the Lord yourself, not on mom and dad's service or grandma and grandpa's service, because you have enemies in your own life. You have enemy in your own territory that you need to conquer. And so it's wonderful that God was with them. It was been wonderful all the things that God has done and kept His promises. Generation after generation, a sulfur fork has stood here. But what about the next generation? What about the next generation? They've got their enemies to conquer as well. They've got their things that will have to be overcome. And they've got to serve the Lord in their own right and in their own way. Every generation must conquer its own land and drive out its own enemies, for they are ever present. Every generation has to do that. We can't do it for our children, because that we can only fight those enemies that are before us in our as we try to take our inheritance. And our children will have to fight their own enemies. There's that drug abuse that Brother Ken was talking about that is sweeping through our land. The sexual immorality that's sweeping through our land. The alliances that are being made with the world through all of these things are enemies to the service of God. And each one of our children have got to fight those things and to overcome them with the help of the Lord themselves. But here was the problem. Here was the problem. I read it in the 10th verse. And there arose another generation after them which knew not the Lord, nor yet the works which He had done for Israel. And when that generation came along, oh, they had all the stories. They'd heard all of the stories of how God had dried up Jordan as they came across. They'd heard all the stories about how that Jericho was taken and the walls fell down. They heard all the stories about the conquest and God's power. But they didn't know the Lord themselves. They just heard stories and new stories. And therefore, they were weak. And they began to serve Balaam. Exactly what God had told them not to do. exactly what God had told them not to do. History repeats itself in every generation. In every generation, this same problem comes up. Every generation has to fight its own enemies. Every generation has to rely upon the Lord. And if they will do that, they can have success. I couldn't live on the successes of my father and my mother as they served the Lord. They taught me about them. They told me what God had done for them. I saw evidence in their life. But when it finally comes down to it, the enemies that are in my life and are in the ever-present about us, the only way to conquer those enemies is day by day trusting in the Lord. Day by day following Him and let Him be the conqueror of those enemies. History repeats itself generation after generation. I give you an example. Why were they cast out of the land? They were cast out of the land because that they had intermarried with the inhabitants of the land. They had become weak. They had taken up the gods and the things of the people that they had intermarried with, and God had told them not to do that. God had told them, do not do that because it will weaken you. Folks, you know as well as I do that when our children grow up, if they marry those who are non-believers, what happens is it weakens their testimony. It weakens that. And many, even right here in this church, have divided families. And they don't serve the Lord together. That division makes an impression upon the children. The children see that division. And that next generation is going to be weaker because of that. It's going to be weaker because of the divisions that are in our lives. Because that there are that we've made alliances with the world, whether those alliances be material things. I'll get to that in just a moment. No, I won't. I'm going to run out of time. But all of those things weaken and disadvantage our children. See, this is really the third generation. This is really the third generation. The first generation, they were turned around in the wilderness because of their unbelief. The second generation saw what happened to them and they got the message real clear. But the third generation, who had luxury, who had much already done for them, and they had seen some failure perhaps even in their own parents, and it weakened them. And rather than take up the fight, it was just easier to make an alliance. Many of our churches, rather than to try to fight and to stand strong, they just weaken and allow those things to enter in. And so, Ezra, 950 years later, after God had already driven them out of the land, why did God drive them out of the land? He drove them out of the land because that they served the idols. They served Balaam and Ashtaroth and all the other gods. And we'll read about that through Judges. We read about that through Samuel and 1 and 2 Samuel and through the times of the kings. And it was a constant fight. All because that initially they didn't drive out the enemy. And there were thorns in their sides and thorns in their eyes. And there were constant scourges upon them. And they were constantly pulling them away from God. And it was a constant battle back and forth. All because that they didn't take care of it in the beginning. And so God finally drove them out of the land. And they drove them into captivity into Babylon. And then, as God promised, that 70 years later, after they'd been driven into captivity, God restored them back into the land, and Ezra received a commission to go there and to reestablish Jerusalem, to build the temple, and to reestablish the land. But what did he find when he got there? What he found was the priests that had been sent there did the exact same thing that the children of Israel did back in the book of Judges. They had intermarried with the women of the land and it had weakened their own testimony. And Ezra was just beside himself because he knew that history was repeating itself and God would not bless them. God would not give them strength. God would not be with them as long as they remain tied to the land and tied to the other gods. And so, again, we find that history repeated itself and it continues to do so today. Our churches are weak because that we have made alliances with the things of the world. You know it's true as well as I do. You might not like to hear these things, but it's true. We're weak because we've made alliances with the things of the world. You know, I found it interesting as I was studying this that there are seven nations that are mentioned that make up what we know as the Canaanites, the land of the Canaan. There are the Amorites and the Havites and the Perizzites and all the various ites. There was about seven of them that made up what was just broadly known as the Canaanites that had inhabited the land. And they had not been driven out. They were thorns in the side of God's people. You know, as I was reading that and thinking about that, I was thinking about what commonly called the seven deadly sins. The seven deadly sins. Now, those were put forth by, I think, Pope Gregory back around 600. But it's based on the same idea. Certain things that need to be driven out of our life, because if they're not, they will consume us. And those seven deadly sins, in case you don't know what they are, you can look them up. But what they are is they're not murder. Anger leads to murder. But they're very simple things that plague each one of us. I guarantee you they plague our church today. One of those seven deadly sins is envy. What is envy? Envy is a desire to have something belonging to someone else. When you want something someone else has got and you envy it, it consumes you. And eventually it will result in some transgression. And so that's an enemy that, as we're saved, that needs to be driven out of us. That we no longer desire the things of other people. Those who are more prosperous than we are. Those who have something that we want. The Apostle Paul said he had learned to be content in no matter what state that he was in. Then there is gluttony. We don't think of that as sin, but it's an excessive want of food or drink. Now, why is that? Why is that a sin? Because that becomes your main objective, is to feed the body, to give it what it wants. And yet the body needs to be disciplined. There are certain foods and things that make us sluggish. There are certain foods and drinks that will change our thinking. And so gluttony is a sin against the body, and our body are to be temples of God. And so we have a great commission to take care of our body, to make sure that it's as usable to God for as long as possible. And so excessive eating or drinking. Greed is one of the seven deadly sins. Excessive pursuit of material possessions. When you become so entangled and engaged in obtaining things, that you forget about God, that you forget about Sunday morning service, or that you forget about the promises that you made to God when He saved your soul, then greed is one of those enemies that is a thorn in your side and keeps you from serving God. Lust is another one of those. Lust is a strong longing for something. Usually it's associated with sexual desire. And we know the consequences of that. Certainly lusting and desiring after something consumes your passion. And will overtake you. And will cause you to make wrong decisions. Many a marriage has been started not from love, but because of lust. And they almost always end in divorce or separation or a miserable marriage. And so lust itself is a great sin against God, and certainly a sin that needs to be driven out of us. And then we have pride. We all know what pride is. Pride is excessive favorable view of yourself without consideration of others, thinking that you're the most important. We have that problem with our children, you see. They think that they're the most important thing in the world. That they need all the attention. Everything's about them. Well, that's what pride is. And when pride matures in an adult, and an adult has those same ideas as a child, all they care about is themselves. And they think that the world centers around them, and that they are the most important thing. And pride, we know, cometh before a fall. And then one of those other seven deadly sins, and we talked a little bit about this in Sunday school this morning. I'm about done. And that's sloth. You know what sloth is? Just being lazy. Lazy. not doing what needs to be done. That's what these people were guilty of. They didn't want the difficulties and the rigors of war. They didn't want to go through all that. They were just lazy. They wanted the easy life. It's a hard thing to do battle. It's a hard thing to go up against your enemy. It's a hard thing sometimes to take a stand against wrong. We tried to take a stand here a couple of years ago just to clean up our role, and we couldn't even do that. We couldn't even take a stand because we were too afraid of offending somebody. And yet, those who are members, we have no idea what they're involved in. We have no idea what they're doing. We would rather just let them go than take the difficult position of taking a stand. That's slothfulness in our duty. That's just as honest as I can be about it. That's being slothful in our duty. And the Lord will not drive our enemies out before us if we don't have enough courage to stand with Him against those who are entangled in the world.
Amen.
If we don't have enough courage, how can we expect Him to help us? How can we expect to have the lights on and have power if that we haven't paid the bill? If we haven't paid the electric bill? How can we expect God to give us power when we care more about whether or not we offend a neighbor who hasn't been to church in 40 years than we do about His honor and His glory? How can we expect God to bless us if our own children are involved in things in the world and yet we don't have enough courage to tell the church that my child is involved in things that they ought not be in and they need a discipline from the church? That's a hard thing to do. I've been down that road. I know how hard it is. It's hard. But we can't expect God to bless us if we don't have enough courage to follow Him and His moral character that He has set before us and what is right and what is wrong. When our children make alliances with the world and they're living together out of marriage, we know that that's wrong. They made alliances with the world. But do we have the courage to do anything about it? Most of the time, not. As I said, we didn't even have the courage to remove people's names from our roll who simply all they had to do was to return a slip of paper to say, I want to remain a member of Sulphur Fork. And 40-some of them didn't do that, and we didn't have enough courage to take their names off the roll. That's shame on us. Shame on us for doing that. How do we expect God to bless us in the next generation if we don't have enough courage to stand up for Him? That's my message. I'm just going to quit. I've already made probably everybody mad. I don't mean to do that. But I want to tell you something. Even in the darkest times, God's promises will still come through. He's always got a remnant. He's always got someone, somewhere. Even when it looks like that all has failed, God said there'll still be witnesses somewhere. Even when Elijah thought he was the only one left, God said, no, I got 7,000. It may not be Sulphur Fork, but there'll be a church somewhere. There'll be one somewhere. There'll be somebody who's part of that remnant who's trying to serve the Lord. And really what the question comes down to is, will you be part of that remnant? Will your children be part of that remnant, or will they be driven out of the land because of the alliances they've made with the world? Brother Jeff, you got a song. I'll leave it. I've been long.